This is the familiar picture of the atom that most of us learned in school, usually under duress. Unfortunately, this picture is obsolete, so you can forget the whole thing. We will discuss later how physicists currently think of an atom. The point here is that the planetary model of the atom formed the background against which a most puzzling problem was solved. The spectrum of hydrogen, the simplest of the atoms, contains over 100 lines. The patterns of the other elements are even more complicated. When we shine the light from excited hydrogen gas through a spectroscope, we get over 100 different lines of color in a distinct pattern. The question is, how can such a simple thing like a hydrogen atom, which has only two components, a proton and an electron, account for such a complex spectrum? Footnote: accurately speaking, different experimental equipment is required to photograph each series of the hydrogen spectrum. Therefore, most single photographs of the hydrogen spectrum show only about 10 lines. Theoretically, there are an infinite number of lines in each atomic spectrum. In fact, theoretically, there are an infinite number of lines in each series of each spectrum because the lines in the higher frequency range of each series become so closely spaced that, in effect, they form a continuum. End of footnote. One way of thinking about light is to ascribe wave-like properties to it, and then to say that different colors have different frequencies, just as different sounds, which also are waves, have different frequencies. Arnold Sommerfeld, a German physicist who was also an accomplished pianist, observed, tongue-in-cheek, that hydrogen atoms, which emit over 100 different frequencies, must be more complicated than grand pianos, which emit only 88 different frequencies. It was a Danish physicist named Niels Bohr who came up with an explanation, in 1913, that made so much sense that it won him a Nobel Prize. Like most ideas in physics, it is essentially simple. Bohr did not start with what was theoretically known about the structure of atoms. He started with what he really knew about atoms. That is, he started with raw spectroscopic data. Bohr speculated that electrons revolve around the nucleus of an atom, not just at any distance, but in orbits or shells, which are specific distances from the nucleus. Each of these shells, theoretically there are an infinite number of them, contains up to a certain number of electrons, but no more. If the atom has more electrons than the first shell can accommodate, the electrons begin to fill up the second shell. If the atom has more electrons than the first and second shells combined can hold, the third shell begins to fill, and so on, like this. Shell number one, number of electrons, 2. Shell number 2, 8 electrons. Shell number 3, 18 electrons. Shell number 4, 32 electrons. Shell number 5, 50 electrons, etc. His calculations were based on the hydrogen atom, which has only one electron. According to Bohr's theory, the electron in the hydrogen atom stays as close to the nucleus as it can get. In other words, it is usually in the first shell. This is the lowest energy state of a hydrogen atom. Physicists call the lowest energy state of any atom its ground state. If we excite an atom of hydrogen, we cause its electron to jump to one of the outer shells. How far it jumps depends upon how much energy we give it. If we really heat the atom up, thermal energy, we cause its electron to make a very large jump all the way to one of the outer shells. Smaller amounts of energy make the electron jump less far. However, as soon as it can, when we stop heating it, the electron returns to a shell closer in. Eventually, it returns all the way back to shell number one. Whenever the electron jumps from an outer shell to an inner shell, it emits energy in the form of light. The energy that the electron emits is exactly the amount of energy that it absorbed when it jumped outward in the first place. Bohr discovered that all of the possible combinations of jumps that the hydrogen electron can make on its journeys back to the ground state, the first shell, equals the number of lines in the hydrogen spectrum. This is Bohr's famous solution to the grand piano mystery. If the electron in a hydrogen atom travels from an outer shell all the way to the innermost shell in one jump, it gives off a certain amount of energy. That makes one line in the hydrogen spectrum. If the electron in a hydrogen atom makes a tiny jump from an outer shell to the next shell inward, it gives off a much smaller amount of energy. That makes another spectral line. If the electron in a hydrogen atom jumps from shell 5 to shell 3, for example, that makes yet another line. A jump from shell 6 to shell 4, and then from shell 4 to shell 1, makes two more spectral lines, and so on. In this way, we can account for the entire hydrogen spectrum. If we excite a hydrogen atom with white light instead of heat, we can produce the absorption phenomenon that we mentioned earlier. Each electron jump from an inner shell to a shell farther out requires a certain amount of energy, no more and no less. An electron jump from shell 1 to shell 2 requires a certain amount of energy, and only that amount. The same is true for a jump from shell 5 to shell 7, etc. Each jump that the electron makes from an inner shell to an outer shell takes a specific amount of energy, no more and no less. When we shine the white light on a hydrogen atom, we are offering it a whole supermarket of different energy amounts. However, it cannot use all that we have to offer, only certain specific amounts. If its electron jumps from shell 1 to shell 4, for example, it takes that particular energy package out of the array of energy packets that we are giving it. The package that it takes out becomes a black line in the otherwise complete spectrum of white light. A jump from shell 3 to shell 4 becomes another black line. A jump from shell 1 to shell 2, and then from shell 2 to shell 6, there are all sorts of combinations, makes two more black lines. In sum, if we shine white light through hydrogen gas and then through a prism, the result is the familiar white light spectrum, but with over 100 black lines in it. Each of these black lines corresponds to a specific energy amount that was required to make a hydrogen electron jump from one shell to another shell farther out. These black lines in the white light spectrum form exactly the same pattern that we get when we shine the light emitted from an excited hydrogen gas directly through a prism, except in that case the lines are colored and the rest of the white light spectrum is missing. Of course, the colored lines are caused by the electrons returning to lower-level shells and in the process emitting energy amounts equal to what they absorbed when we first made them jump. Bohr's theory permitted physicists to calculate the frequencies of the light given off by simple hydrogen atoms. These calculations agreed with observations. The grand piano mystery was solved. Shortly after Bohr published his theory in 1913, an army of physicists began the work of applying it to the other elements. This process was quite complicated for atoms with large numbers of electrons, and not all of the questions that physicists had about the nature of atomic phenomena were answered. Nonetheless, a tremendous amount of knowledge was gained from this work. Most of the physicists who went to work on Bohr's theory, applying it and further developing it, were technicians. Bohr himself, one of the founders of the new physics, was a scientist. This is not to say that technicians are not important. The technician and the scientist form a partnership. Bohr could not have formulated his theory without the wealth of spectroscopic data at his disposal. That data was the result of countless laboratory hours. It was beyond Bohr's capacity as one person to substantiate his theory. Technicians did this for him by applying it to the other elements. Technicians are important members of the scientific community. However, since this is a book about Wu Li masters and not about technicians, we will use the word physicist from now on to mean those physicists who are also scientists, that is, those physicists, people, who are not confined by the known. From the little that we know about Wu Li masters, it is evident that they come from this group. There are certain limitations which no book on physics can overcome. First, there is so much to present that not even 20 volumes could contain it all. There is that much new material published each year. Even physicists find it impossible to keep abreast of the whole field. It requires a steady diet of reading just to keep current in one area. For everything that is included in these pages, there is much more that is not. No matter how much you learn about physics, there always will be something that is new to you. Physicists have this problem too. Second, no complete appreciation of physics is possible without mathematics. Nonetheless, there is no mathematics in the dancing Wu Li masters. Mathematics is a highly structured way of thinking. Physicists view the world in this way. One point of view is that they impose this structure on what they see. Another point of view is that the world presents itself most completely through such structures. In any case, mathematics is the most concise expression of physics. The reason for writing The Dancing Woolly Masters, however, is that most physicists are not able to explain physics very well without it. This makes them very concise, but unfortunately unintelligible. The fact is that most of us use words to do our explaining. However, it is important to remember that mathematics and English are both languages. Languages are useful tools for conveying information, but if we try to communicate experiences with them, they simply do not work. All a language can do is talk about an experience. Woolly masters know that a description of an experience is not the experience. It is only talk about it. This is a book about physics. Therefore, all it contains is a description. It cannot contain the experience itself. This does not mean that you will not have the experience of physics by reading it. It only means that if you do, the experience is coming from you and not from the book. Quantum mechanics, for example, shows us that we are not as separate from the rest of the world as we once thought. Particle physics shows us that the rest of the world does not sit idly out there. It is a sparkling realm of continual creation, transformation, and annihilation. The ideas of the new physics, when wholly grasped, can produce extraordinary experiences. The study of relativity theory, for example, can produce the remarkable experience that space and time are only mental constructions. Each of these different experiences is capable of changing us in such ways that we never again are able to view the world as we did before. There is no single experience of physics. The experience always is changing. Relativity and quantum mechanics, although generally unknown to non-physicists, are more than a half century old. Today, the entire field of physics is quivering with anticipation. The air is charged with excitement. A feeling is shared among physicists that radical change is at hand. A consensus grows that the near future will see new theories exploding onto the scene, incorporating the older theories and giving us a much larger view of our universe and, consequently, of ourselves. The Woolly Masters move in the midst of all this, now dancing this way, now that, sometimes with a heavy beat, sometimes with a lightness and grace, ever flowing freely. Now they become the dance, now the dance becomes them. This is the message of the Woolly Masters, not to confuse the type of dance that they are doing with the fact that they are dancing. Chapter 1. Einstein Doesn't Like It. Quantum mechanics are not the fellows who repair automobiles in Mr. Quantum's garage. Quantum mechanics is a branch of physics. There are several branches of physics. Most physicists believe that sooner or later they will construct an overview large enough to incorporate them all. According to this point of view, we eventually will develop, in principle, a theory which is capable of explaining everything so well that there will be nothing left to explain. This does not mean, of course, that our explanation necessarily will reflect the way that things actually are. We will still not be able to open the watch, as Einstein put it, but every occurrence in the real world, inside the watch, will be accounted for by a corresponding element of our final super theory. We will have, at last, a theory that is consistent within itself and which explains all observable phenomena. Einstein called this state the ideal limit of knowledge. This way of thinking runs into quantum mechanics the same way that the car runs into the proverbial brick wall. Einstein spent a large portion of his career arguing against quantum mechanics, even though he himself made major contributions to its development. Why did he do this? To ask this question is to stand at the edge of an abyss, still on the solid ground of Newtonian physics, but looking into the void. To answer it is to leap boldly into the new physics. Quantum mechanics forced itself upon the scene at the beginning of this century. No convention of physicists voted to start a new branch of physics called quantum mechanics. No one had any choice in the matter, except perhaps what to call it. A quantum is a quantity of something, a specific amount. Mechanics is the study of motion. Therefore, quantum mechanics is the study of the motion of quantities. Quantum theory says that nature comes in bits and pieces, quanta, and quantum mechanics is the study of this phenomenon. Quantum mechanics does not replace Newtonian physics. It includes it. The physics of Newton remains valid within its limits. To say that we have made a major new discovery about nature is one side of a coin. The other side of the coin is to say that we have found the limits of our previous theories. What we actually discover is that the way that we have been looking at nature is no longer comprehensive enough to explain all that we can observe, and we are forced to develop a more inclusive view. In Einstein's words, "Creating a new theory is not like destroying an old barn and erecting a skyscraper in its place. It is rather like climbing a mountain, gaining new and wider views, discovering unexpected connections between our starting point and its rich environment. But the point from which we started out still exists and can be seen, although it appears smaller, and forms a tiny part of our broad view gained by the mastery of the obstacles on our adventurous way up." Newtonian physics is still applicable to the large-scale world, but it does not work in the subatomic realm. Quantum mechanics resulted from the study of the subatomic realm, that invisible universe underlying, embedded in, and forming the fabric of everything around us. In Newton's age, late 1600s, this realm was entirely speculation. The idea that the atom is the indivisible building block of nature was proposed about 400 years before Christ, but until the late 1800s it remained just an idea. Then physicists developed the technology to observe the effects of atomic phenomena, thereby proving, quote-unquote, that atoms exist. Of course, what they really proved was that the theoretical existence of atoms was the best explanation of the experimental data that anyone could invent at the time. They also proved that atoms are not indivisible, but themselves are made up of particles smaller yet, such as electrons, protons, and neutrons. These new particles were labeled elementary particles because physicists believed that at last they really had discovered the ultimate building blocks of the universe. The elementary particle theory is a recent version of an old Greek idea. To understand the theory of elementary particles, imagine a large city made entirely of bricks. The city is filled with buildings of all shapes and sizes. Every one of them, and the streets as well, have been constructed with only a few different types of brick. If we substitute universe for city and particle for brick, we have the theory of elementary particles. It was the study of elementary particles that brought physicists nose to nose with the most devastating, to a physicist, discovery. Newtonian physics does not work in the realm of the very small. The impact of that earth-shaking discovery still is reshaping our worldview. Quantum mechanical experiments repeatedly produced results which the physics of Newton could neither predict nor explain. Yet although Newton's physics could not account for phenomena in the microscopic realm, it continued to explain macroscopic phenomena very well, even though the macroscopic is made of the microscopic. This was perhaps the most profound discovery of science. Newton's laws are based upon observations of the everyday world. They predict events. These events pertain to real things, like baseballs and bicycles. Quantum mechanics is based upon experiments conducted in the subatomic realm. It predicts probabilities. These probabilities pertain to subatomic phenomena. Subatomic phenomena cannot be observed directly. None of our senses can detect them. Not only has no one ever seen an atom, much less an electron, no one has ever tasted, touched, heard, or smelled one, either. Footnote: the dark-adapted eye can detect a single photon. Otherwise, only the effects of subatomic phenomena are available to our senses, a track on a photographic plate, a pointer movement on a meter, etc. End of footnote. Newton's laws depict events which are simple to understand and easy to picture. Quantum mechanics depicts the probabilities of phenomena which defy conceptualization and are impossible to visualize. Therefore, these phenomena must be understood in a way that is not more difficult than our usual way of understanding, but different from it. Do not try to make a complete mental picture of quantum mechanical events. Physicists make partial pictures of quantum phenomena, but even these pictures have a questionable value. Instead, allow yourself to be open without making an effort to visualize anything. Werner Heisenberg, one of the founders of quantum physics, wrote, "The mathematically formulated laws of quantum theory show clearly that our ordinary intuitive concepts cannot be unambiguously applied to the smallest particles. All the words or concepts we use to describe ordinary physical objects, such as position, velocity, color, size, and so on, become indefinite and problematic if we try to use them of elementary particles. The idea that we do not understand something until we have a picture of it in our heads is a byproduct of the Newtonian way of looking at the world. If we want to get past Newton, we have to get past that. Newton's first great contribution to science was the laws of motion. If an object, said Newton, is moving in a straight line, it will continue moving in a straight line forever, unless it is acted upon by something else, a force. At that time, its direction and speed will be altered, depending upon the magnitude and direction of the force which it encounters. Furthermore, every action is accompanied by an equal and opposite reaction. Today, these concepts are familiar to anyone who has studied physics or hung out in a pool hall. However, if we mentally project ourselves 300 years into the past, we can see how remarkable they really are. First, Newton's first law of motion defied the accepted authority of the day, which was Aristotle. According to Aristotle, the natural inclination for a moving object is to return to a state of rest. Second, Newton's laws of motion describe events which were unobservable in the 1600s. In the everyday world, which was all that Newton had to observe, moving objects always do return to a state of rest because of friction. If we put a wagon in motion, it encounters friction from the air through which it passes, from the ground its tires move on, from the axles that its wheels turn around, and unless it is rolling downhill, sooner or later it comes to rest. We can streamline the wagon, grease the wheels, and use a smooth road, but this only reduces the effect of friction. Eventually, the wagon stops moving, apparently on its own. Newton never had the chance to see a film of astronauts in space, but he predicted what they would encounter. When an astronaut releases a pencil in front of him, nothing happens. It just stays there. If he gives it a push, off it goes in the direction of the push until it bumps into a wall. If the wall were not there, the pencil would continue to move uniformly, in principle, forever. The astronaut also moves off in the opposite direction, but much more slowly because of his greater mass. Third, Newton's premise was, I make no hypotheses, hypotheses non fingo, which means that he based his laws upon sound experimental evidence and nothing else. His criteria for the validity of everything that he wrote was that anyone should be able to reproduce his experiments and come up with the same results. If it could be verified experimentally, it was true. If it could not be verified experimentally, it was suspect. The church took a dim view, to say the least, of this position. Since it had been saying things for 1,500 years which hardly were subject to experimental verification, Newtonian physics, in effect, was a direct challenge to the power of the church. The power of the church was considerable. Shortly before Newton's birth, Galileo was seized by the Inquisition for declaring that the earth revolves around the sun and for drawing unacceptable theological implications from his beliefs. He was forced to recant on penalty of imprisonment or worse. This made a considerable impression on many people, among them another founder of modern science, the Frenchman René Descartes. Footnote: at the time of Newton's discoveries, the power of the church already had been challenged by Martin Luther. Newton himself was a pious person. The specific argument of the church was not with empirical method, but with the theological conclusions that were being developed from Newton's ideas, conclusions which involved the concept of God as creator and the central position of man in creation. End of footnote. In the 1630s, Descartes visited the royal gardens at Versailles, which were known for their intricate automata. When water was made to flow, music sounded, sea nymphs began to play, and a giant Neptune, complete with trident, advanced menacingly. Whether the idea was in his mind before this visit or not, Descartes' philosophy, which he supported with his mathematics, became that the universe and all of the things in it also were automata. From Descartes' time to the beginning of this century, and perhaps because of him, our ancestors began to see the universe as a great machine. Over the next 300 years, they developed science specifically to discover how the great machine worked. Newton's second great contribution to science was his law of gravity. Gravity is a remarkable phenomenon, even though we take it for granted. For example, if we hold a ball off the ground and then release it, the ball falls straight down to the ground. But how did that happen? The ground did not reach up and pull the ball down, yet the ball was pulled to the earth. The old physics called this unexplainable phenomenon action at a distance. Newton himself was as puzzled as anyone. He wrote in his famous Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, "I have not been able to discover the cause of those properties of gravity from phenomena, and I frame no hypotheses. It is enough that gravity does really exist, and act according to the laws which we have explained, and abundantly serves to account for all the motions of the celestial bodies." Newton clearly felt that a true understanding of the nature of gravity was beyond comprehension. In a letter to Richard Bentley, a classical scholar, he wrote, "That one body may act upon another at a distance through a vacuum without the mediation of anything else, by and through which their action and force may be conveyed from one to another, is to me so great an absurdity that I believe no man, who has in philosophic matters a competent faculty of thinking, could ever fall into it." In short, action at a distance could be described, but it could not be explained. Newton's thesis was that the same force which pulls apples downward also keeps the moon in orbit around the Earth and the planets in orbit around the Sun. To test his idea, he calculated various movements of the moon and the planets using his own mathematics. Then he compared his findings with the observations of astronomers. His calculations and their observations matched. In one stroke, Newton set aside the assumption of an essential difference between earthly and heavenly objects by showing that both of them are governed by the same laws. He established a rational celestial mechanics. What had been the purview of the gods, or God, came now within the comprehension of mortals. Newton's gravitational law does not explain gravity, that was done by Einstein in his general theory of relativity, but it does subject the effects of gravity to a rigorous mathematical formalism. Newton was the first person to discover principles in nature which unify large tracts of experience. He abstracted certain unifying concepts from the endless diversity of nature and gave those concepts mathematical expression. Because of this, more than anything else, Newton's work has influenced us so forcefully. Newton showed us that the phenomena of the universe are structured in rationally comprehensible ways. He gave us the most powerful tool in history. In the West, we have used this tool, if not wisely, certainly to the best of our ability. The results, both positive and negative, have been spectacular. The story of our enormous impact on our environment begins with the work of Newton. It was Galileo Galilei who, following the Middle Ages, first quantified the physical world. He measured the motion, frequency, velocity, and duration of everything from falling stones to swinging pendulums, like the chandelier in his cathedral. It was René Descartes who developed many of the fundamental techniques of modern mathematics and gave us the picture of the universe as a great machine. It was Isaac Newton who formulated the laws by which the great machine runs. These men struck boldly against the grip of scholasticism, the medieval thought system of the 12th to the 15th centuries. They attempted to place man at the center of the stage, or at least back on the stage, to prove to him that he need not be a bystander in a world governed by unfathomable forces. It is perhaps the greatest irony of history that they accomplished just the opposite. Joseph Weizenbaum, a scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, wrote in reference to computers, "Science promised man power. But, as so often happens when people are seduced by promises of power, the price is servitude and impotence. Power is nothing if it is not the power to choose." How did this happen? Newton's laws of motion describe what happens to a moving object. Once we know the laws of motion, we can predict the future of a moving object, provided that we know certain things about it initially. The more initial information that we have, the more accurate our predictions will be. We also can retrodict, predict backward in time, the past history of a given object. For example, if we know the present position and velocity of the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun, we can predict where the Earth will be in relation to the Moon and the Sun at any particular time in the future, giving us a foreknowledge of eclipses, seasons, and so on. In like manner, we can calculate where the Earth has been in relation to the Moon and the Sun, and when similar phenomena occurred in the past. Without Newtonian physics, the space program would not be possible. Moon probes are launched at the precise moment when the launch site on the Earth, which simultaneously is rotating around its axis and moving forward through space, is in a position relative to the landing zone on the Moon, which also is rotating and moving, such that the path traversed by the spacecraft is the shortest possible. The calculations of the Earth, Moon, and spacecraft movements are done by computer, but the mechanics used are the same ones that are described in Newtonian's Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica. In practice, it is very difficult to know all the initial circumstances pertaining to an event. Even a simple action such as bouncing a ball off a wall is surprisingly complex. The shape, size, elasticity, and momentum of the ball, the angle at which it was thrown, the density, pressure, humidity, and temperature of the air, the shape, hardness, and position of the wall, to name a few of the essential elements, are all required to know where and when the ball will land. It is increasingly difficult to obtain all of the data necessary for accurate predictions when more complex actions are involved. According to the old physics, however, it is possible, in principle, to predict exactly how a given event is going to unfold if we have enough information about it. In practice, it is only the enormity of the task that prevents us from accomplishing it. The ability to predict the future based on a knowledge of the present and the laws of motion gave our ancestors a power they had never known. However, these concepts carry within them a very dispiriting logic. If the laws of nature determine the future of an event, then, given enough information, we could have predicted our present at some time in the past. That time in the past also could have been predicted at a time still earlier. In short, if we are to accept the mechanistic determination of Newtonian physics, if the universe really is a great machine, then from the moment that the universe was created and set into motion, everything that was to happen in it already was determined. According to this philosophy, we may seem to have a will of our own and the ability to alter the course of events in our lives, but we do not. Everything from the beginning of time has been predetermined, including our illusion of having a free will. The universe is a pre-recorded tape playing itself out in the only way that it can. The status of men is immeasurably more dismal than it was before the advent of science. The great machine runs blindly on, and all things in it are but cogs. According to quantum mechanics, however, it is not possible, even in principle, to know enough about the present to make a complete prediction about the future. Even if we have the time and the determination, it is not possible. Even if we have the best possible measuring devices, it is not possible. It is not a matter of the size of the task or the inefficiency of detectors. The very nature of things is such that we must choose which aspect of them we wish to know best, for we can know only one of them with precision. As Niels Bohr, another founder of quantum mechanics, put it, "In quantum mechanics, we are not dealing with an arbitrary renunciation of a more detailed analysis of atomic phenomena, but with a recognition that such an analysis is, in principle, excluded." For example, imagine an object moving through space. It has both a position and a momentum which we can measure. This is an example of the old Newtonian physics. Momentum is a combination of how big an object is, how fast it is going, and the direction that it is moving. Since we can determine both the position and the momentum of the object at a particular time, it is not a very difficult affair to calculate where it will be at some point in the future. If we see an airplane flying north at 200 miles per hour, we know that in 1 hour it will be 200 miles farther north if it does not change its course or speed. The mind-expanding discovery of quantum mechanics is that Newtonian physics does not apply to subatomic phenomena. In the subatomic realm, we cannot know both the position and the momentum of a particle with absolute precision. We can know both approximately, but the more we know about one, the less we know about the other. We can know either of them precisely, but in that case we can know nothing about the other. This is Werner Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. As incredible as it seems, it has been verified repeatedly by experiment. Of course, if we picture a moving particle, it is very difficult to imagine not being able to measure both its position and momentum. Not to be able to do so defies our common sense. This is not the only quantum mechanical phenomenon which contradicts common sense. Common sense contradictions, in fact, are at the heart of the new physics. They tell us again and again that the world may not be what we think it is. It may be much, much more. Since we cannot determine both the position and momentum of subatomic particles, we cannot predict much about them. Accordingly, quantum mechanics does not and cannot predict specific events. It does, however, predict probabilities. Probabilities are the odds that something is going to happen, or that it is not going to happen. Quantum theory can predict the probability of a microscopic event with the same precision that Newtonian physics can predict the actual occurrence of a macroscopic event. Newtonian physics says, if such and such is the case now, then such and such is going to happen next. Quantum mechanics says, if such and such is the case now, then the probability that such and such is going to happen next is whatever it is calculated to be. We never can know with certainty what will happen to the particle that we are observing, quote-unquote. All that we can know for sure are the probabilities for it to behave in certain ways. This is the most that we can know because the two data which must be included in a Newtonian calculation, position and momentum, cannot both be known with precision. We must choose, by the selection of our experiment, which one we want to measure most accurately. The lesson of Newtonian physics is that the universe is governed by laws that are susceptible to rational understanding. By applying these laws, we extend our knowledge of, and therefore our influence over, our environment. Newton was a religious person. He saw his laws as manifestations of God's perfection. Nonetheless, Newton's laws served man's cause well. They enhanced his dignity and vindicated his importance in the universe. Following the Middle Ages, the new field of science, natural philosophy, came like a fresh breeze to revitalize the spirit. It is ironic that, in the end, natural philosophy reduced the status of men to that of helpless cogs in a machine whose functioning had been preordained from the day of its creation. Contrary to Newtonian physics, quantum mechanics tells us that our knowledge of what governs events on the subatomic level is not nearly what we assumed it would be. It tells us that we cannot predict subatomic phenomena with any certainty. We can only predict their probabilities. Philosophically, however, the implications of quantum mechanics are psychedelic. Not only do we influence our reality, but in some degree we actually create it, because it is the nature of things that we can know either the momentum of a particle or its position, but not both. We must choose which of these two properties we want to determine. Metaphysically, this is very close to saying that we create certain properties because we choose to measure those properties. Said another way, it is possible that we create something that has position, for example, like a particle, because we are intent on determining position, and it is impossible to determine position without having some thing occupying the position that we want to determine. Quantum physicists ponder questions like, did a particle with momentum exist before we conducted an experiment to measure its momentum? Did a particle with position exist before we conducted an experiment to measure its position? And did any particles exist at all before we thought about them and measured them? Did we create the particles that we are experimenting with? Incredible as it sounds, this is a possibility that many physicists recognize. John Wheeler, a well-known physicist at Princeton, wrote, "May the universe in some strange sense be brought into being by the participation of those who participate?" The vital act is the act of participation. Participator is the incontrovertible new concept given by quantum mechanics. It strikes down the term observer of classical theory, the man who stands safely behind the thick glass wall and watches what goes on without taking part. It can't be done, quantum mechanics says. The languages of Eastern mystics and Western physicists are becoming very similar. Newtonian physics and quantum mechanics are partners in a double irony. Newtonian physics is based upon the idea of laws which govern phenomena and the power inherent in understanding them, but it leads to impotence in the face of a great machine which is the universe. Quantum mechanics is based upon the idea of minimal knowledge of future phenomena. We are limited to knowing probabilities, but it leads to the possibility that our reality is what we choose to make it. There is another fundamental difference between the old physics and the new physics. The old physics assumes that there is an external world which exists apart from us. It further assumes that we can observe, measure, and speculate about the external world without changing it. According to the old physics, the external world is indifferent to us and to our needs. Galileo's historical stature stems from his tireless and successful efforts to quantify, measure, the phenomena of the external world. There is great power inherent in the process of quantification. For example, once a relationship is discovered, like the rate of acceleration of a falling object, it matters not who drops the object, what object is dropped, or where the dropping takes place. The results are always the same. An experimenter in Italy gets the same results as a Russian experimenter who repeats the experiment a century later. The results are the same whether the experiment is done by a skeptic, a believer, or a curious bystander. Facts like these convinced philosophers that the physical universe goes unheedingly on its way, doing what it must without regard for its inhabitants. For example, if we simultaneously drop two people from the same height, it is a verifiable, repeatable fact that they both will hit the ground at the same time, regardless of their weights. We can measure their fall, acceleration, and impact the same way that we measure the fall, acceleration, and impact of stones. In fact, the results will be the same as if they were stones. But there is a difference between people and stones, you might say. Stones have no opinions or emotions. People have both. One of these dropped people, for example, might be frightened by his experience, and the other might be angry. Don't their feelings have any importance in this scheme? No. The feelings of our subjects matter not in the least. When we take them up the tower again, struggling this time, and drop them off again, they fall with the same acceleration and duration that they did the first time, even though now, of course, they are both fighting mad. The great machine is impersonal. In fact, it was precisely this impersonality that inspired scientists to strive for absolute objectivity. The concept of scientific objectivity rests upon the assumption of an external world which is out there, as opposed to an I, which is in here. This way of perceiving, which puts other people out there, makes it very lonely in here. According to this view, nature in all her diversity is out there. The task of the scientist is to observe the out there as objectively as possible. To observe something objectively means to see it as it would appear to an observer who has no prejudices about what he observes. The problem that went unnoticed for three centuries is that a person who carries such an attitude certainly is prejudiced. His prejudice is to be objective, that is, to be without a preformed opinion. In fact, it is impossible to be without an opinion. An opinion is a point of view. The point of view that we can be without a point of view is a point of view. The decision itself to study one segment of reality instead of another is a subjective expression of the researcher who makes it. It affects his perceptions of reality, if nothing else. Since reality is what we are studying, the matter gets very sticky here.